Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Today's guest, Jane Marie Chen, is a TED speaker, inventor, author, and a young global leader of the World Economic Forum. She has been selected for Forbes Impact 300 and is a recipient of the Economist Innovation Award and Fast Company Innovation Award. Jane has also been recognized as the Social Entrepreneur of the Year by the World Economic Forum. Her work has been featured in global media, including the New York Times, CNN, Newsweek, and ABC, and more. She's received her MBA from Stanford Graduate School of Business and her master's in public administration from Harvard Kennedy School of Government. In addition to this long list of accomplishments, Jane is also a trauma survivor. Raised in an abusive household, Jane grew up believing she was an imposter, not good enough, and that her value came from her accomplishments. The failure of her life's work sent her into a tailspin of anxiety, self-doubt, and failed relationships. But this failure also set her on a quest to heal herself and to find a place of self-acceptance and joy. On today's program, we will be discussing Jane's new book, Like a Wave We Break, a memoir of falling apart and finding myself. Welcome to the program, Jane. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we were discussing a little bit before the break. I've read a lot of books on trauma as a therapist who works with people. I mean, if you're a therapist, you work with people who experience trauma. It's throughout everyone's story, big or small, little T's or big T's, as Dr. Vander Kolk says. And I told you beforehand, my three favorite books on this are Dr. Vander Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, which I had the pleasure of interviewing him about. And that's a really academic, science-based exploration of PTSD and trauma. And then Olga Trujillo, her book about DID, dissociative identity disorder, and The Sum of My Parts, which is a hard read and it's deep. But this book is a beautiful book. And it's one that I told you I felt like I was bathing in love and hope throughout this whole book, even though there's lots of it that is raw and vulnerable that you share in there.
So, I love you saying that.
Well, I really appreciate it. And I'm going to start off today's program a little bit differently, and I'm going to just read, if you'll bear with me, a passage from your book. It's just one page in the book, but I wanted the readers or my listeners to get a feel for how you write and how lovely it is. So here we go. There, hovering in the stillness, was me, or a version of me. Her body was almost translucent, as if made from light. Her expression was soft and serene. She radiated a gentle, loving energy. She was smiling as if she'd been expecting me. And somehow I knew this was the version of me free from pain, from the weight of the past, my truest essence, my higher self. A thought flashed in my mind. I want to understand what happened with Patrick. Not yet, my higher self said gently, taking my hands in hers. Scenes from my childhood slowly began to take shape, but this time I wasn't alone. My higher self was there with me. She held 4-year-old me after the first beating I remembered. Punished for a harmless swat at a classmate's arm, I felt the sharp ache in the little girl's chest as her father struck her. I saw her scrambling to make sense of it, to understand what she had done wrong. And when she couldn't, I felt a small part of her slip away. I felt her tiny heart break. She held 7-year-old me, beaten for not finishing her extra math homework. I felt the stinging of the leather belt slashing her arm, every lash an explosion of pain as she shook and begged silently for it to stop. She held 12-year-old me kneeling on the floor. I felt the slap of her father's hand across her face, the crack of her glasses against her nose. But worse than the pain was a realization that no one was coming to help her. Help me. A tsunami of sadness washed over me. As a child, I had never been witnessed in my pain, not by my mother or my sisters or my friends, but in the arms of my higher self, I felt the safety I needed to grieve. Healing wasn't about erasing the hurt, I realized. It was about allowing it to be seen and felt, about learning to meet it with compassion and tenderness. All right, I need to take a second to remind listeners, this is a pre-recorded show. We won't be able to take phone calls. This one, I guess, would generate a lot if we did have you live, so it's too bad for that. But it also gives us a chance to really go through this story in this book and hear a little bit about your life. So I really do appreciate you coming in and being here with me. It's a real honor. So let's start off with the story of Embrace. How did it come about? The challenges and victories and what led to its ultimate failure that sent you off on this journey?
Yeah, so Embrace started, I was a graduate school student at Stanford. This was back in 2007. And I took a course called Design for Extreme Affordability. It's a design school course that's all about creating technologies for people living on less than a dollar a day. So the specific challenge posed in that class that year, one of the challenges you could work on was to build a baby incubator that costs 1% of a traditional incubator, which in the US at the time was $20,000 and upwards. I teamed up with three other graduate students in the different engineering programs, and we started researching this problem. And what we discovered was that 15 million preterm and underweight babies are born every year, but many of them are born in developing countries where there's a lack of electricity. There's no stable electricity, and often families can't even get to a hospital, right? And so what we ended up creating looked nothing like an incubator. It looks like a little sleeping bag for a baby. The core technology is a wax-like substance that, when melted, maintains the exact same temperature for up to 6 hours at a time, and you can simply reheat that little pouch of wax. And that is enough to maintain the warmth of these babies, maintain the temperature, which is the primary function of an incubator.
Yeah.
And so we came up with this concept, and I moved to India right after I graduated. India is home to 40% of the world's premature and underweight babies. And we got this organization off the ground, which was very exciting, but also incredibly challenging, you know. And once we launched the product, we saved thousands of lives, but we also encountered setback after setback after setback, whether that be, you know, manufacturing issues, distribution issues, fundraising, you know, challenges. And so 10 years in, we ran out of money, essentially, and we had to shut down the company. And that brought me to just the worst point of my life. I'd poured 10 years of my heart and soul and every ounce of my being into this company, and I felt like a total failure.
And you set it up beautifully. I mean, the story of the work that you put in, along with your constant doubt and your battling panic, right, and trying to lead this as the CEO of this organization, there's this internal struggle to feel worthy of being in that position. And that, you know, so along with the story of Embrace, the first part of the book is also about your sense of not being good enough and not really knowing where that came from or understanding it, right?
Yeah, I had such imposter syndrome being in graduate school. I was sure I was the admissions mistake at Stanford. And then once I started my company, I just was full of doubt. Like, I didn't think I was fit to be the CEO, but I just really wanted to do this work. And that I didn't even understand. People would ask, like, why are you moving to India? Why are you sacrificing your whole life? You graduate from Stanford Business School, you could go get a high paying job. And I never knew the answer, honestly. It just felt this like fire in my belly, like I have to do this. And at the same time, I felt just incredible doubt every step of the way. Like, am I fit to do this? Am I enough? You know, I talk about in the book an incident at Stanford where I had to give a talk in front of all my classmates. And I was so anxious that I literally blacked out. Like, I had to leave the room, and I was mortified. I was so ashamed, you know, and, you know, I had grown up with my father telling me how stupid I was constantly. But it still hadn't like registered to me fully that's why I didn't feel worthy.
Right. That it wasn't you. It was your child self. And that deeply held belief that was deeper than your consciousness. Right. All right. Well, that's the perfect segue into, you telling us a little bit about those childhood experiences and how they shaped the beliefs you held about yourself and your inherent worth.
Yeah. Well, once the company collapsed, I was in the worst place of my life. I was having panic attacks. I couldn't sleep. I was totally depressed. And I decided I needed to get away from everything, you know, to find myself again. And so I packed up my bags. I bought a one-way ticket to Indonesia. And I just dove into healing. You know, I was ready to try any kind of healing modality I could get my hands on. And that was what led me to really confront my childhood, you know, being on that path. And what happened was I started to connect the dots, right? That I experienced a lot of physical violence in my childhood. And I didn't realize that it was feeling so powerless throughout my childhood. That's what had driven me to help the most powerless people in the world. I never connected those dots. You know, but the shadow side of it was that I still never felt like I was enough. And no matter how many, you know, babies I saved or accolades I won, there's just this void that nothing could fill. And the sense of like, okay, you have to do more, 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 to the point where I worked to like utter and complete burnout and had a like mental and physical breakdown at the end of that 10 years. And so I was really kind of, again, forced to confront the events of my childhood. And I was, I'm a first generation Taiwanese American immigrant, and corporal punishment was just part of my upbringing and very much part of the culture as well. And so I believe that it was just like a normal thing. I never thought to talk about it. I never knew there was anything wrong with it, but there are moments I talk about in the book where, you know, I would get beaten and have lash marks all over me. And I remember in second grade, my mother said to me, you know, make sure no one sees this.
Yeah, tucking in your shirt so that when you were on the jungle gym, people, your shirt wouldn't raise up and people would see the marks. That's really powerful.
Yeah. And so I both felt like, oh, well, I was told this is normal. This is part of culture. And I was also told, hide this. Make sure no one sees this. And I think that message just made me bury what happened, right? Just pretend this isn't happening. Don't show anybody. Don't even acknowledge it yourself. Don't even acknowledge the pain. So I spent, you know, most of my life up until my late 30s, just kind of sweeping this under the rug. It's like, I knew it happened, but I had no idea the extent to which it impacted me.
And the onus was on you to not tell, to not speak, right? And that pressure, and I mean, you internalize that as your responsibility to protect your family. And you just thought everybody was beaten. That's the message you got told.
I thought every other Asian family this happened, and you know, this is part of the culture. And you know, we were striving to belong. Like my parents didn't speak English when we moved. I barely spoke English. Like I didn't want to stand out. I didn't want to call out more attention to myself. Right. And so in this striving to belong, I had to hide anything that felt painful.
All right. I need to take a second for anybody who might be tuning in late. My guest today is Jane Marie Chen, who is an author, inventor, and speaker, among many other hats that you've worn throughout your life. Today, we are discussing her new book, Like a Wave We Break, a book about trauma, falling apart, resiliency, and the courage to heal. Please take note that today's program is pre-recorded and we will not be able to accept phone calls or emails. So just sit back and enjoy the conversation. You know, my grandmother started reading late in life, my mother's mother, and she was high school educated and grew up, you know, on a farm and worked on a farm, and she's just a wonderful woman and always had her house was filled with love and, you know, good food and great smells. And but she started reading at my mother's suggestion, and my mother would give her books, and she read John Grisham's The Painted House. And my mother asked her, how did you, what'd you think about the book? And she said, it was a good book. She goes, but what I really liked the pictures. And anybody that's read a Grisham book, there's no pictures. And that's what I got from your book. Like, I can see the little girl. I can see your parents struggle. Like, I have images of you riding a wave, right? Which we'll get into. And that's the way you write. It just, it does. It paints pictures. And it's really beautiful. And I'm not usually a fanboy, and I don't go over the top like this, but I don't know. I've given it to a bunch of people already. So let's keep moving along. Like, I guess you touched on how the failure of Embrace kind of just put into motion this this quest. And, you know, I can, I also see like you getting burned to put tree frog poison in your leg, and you know, all the stuff that you tried. You just, if somebody said this will help, you went after it. Silent retreats for weeks, not speaking, just all, stuff that MDMA journeys, like this is all in the book. And so can you, I mean, talk a little bit more about that quest, and I guess also how surfing came in.
Sure. Yeah. So that quest was like, I just, like I said, felt like shit, and I wanted to feel better. So I put on my CEO hat. I made an Excel spreadsheet of like every healing modality that I had ever heard about, that anyone told me about. And I was just like, gonna try all of them. If something didn't work, I'd pivot to the next thing. You know, I was desperate to find a solution. And so that was everything from frog poisoning to, as you said, MDMA journey, silent meditation in the jungle, every self-help seminar I could find, different healers, teachers, really, you know, all of it. Surfing, I had discovered before, we could talk about that in a moment, but I would say a couple of like big things happened in my healing journey. You referenced Bessel's book. That was a real eye opener for me, reading The Body Keeps the Score, right? Because up until that point, what I didn't understand is that trauma is not just something that lives in the past. And that's what I believe. This thing happened in the past. Why bring it up again? Why talk about it, right? Just bury it under the rug and like I've moved on. But what I've discovered in that book is trauma actually rewires your brain and your nervous system. So it's the way that you bring the past into the present. And it affects every part of your life. And I remember reading his book and weeping. It's an academic book, but I was weeping because for the first time I had self-compassion. And I realized that my reactions, this like constant feeling of not enoughness, all the things that like I would feel a certain way and then criticize myself for feeling that way. And I finally understood, okay, no, my brain is wired differently as a result of what happened to me. And that allowed me to start approaching it differently. You know, the other thing that Bessel talks about is that trauma is stored in the limbic system. It's stored in our limbic brains, the part responsible for feelings and connection. Not in the neocortex, not in our thinking brains. So talk therapy, I'd had, you know, challenges with aspects of talk therapy, and I realized like I needed to go deeper. And so that's what led me both to things like psychedelic therapy, which was incredibly helpful for me, and also to parts work. Yeah. And I found parts work, Bessel introduced me to that. I have just benefited so much from that. And for folks who might not be familiar with parts work or internal family systems, it's a therapeutic modality that is based on the premise that all of us have all these different parts, right? So you might have an overachiever part, a control freak part, a perfectionist part, the inner critic, right? All these parts that arise to protect us. And then we have parts that carry more painful feelings like shame and rejection and abandonment. And so the point of this practice is, how do we recognize these parts and then relate to them differently? How do we have love and compassion for all of our parts instead of trying to shame them or banish them? And it was through, you know, a number of these practices that I started learning self-compassion.
Yeah, the work that you did is remarkable. And, you know, as the overachiever you are, you ended up weaseling your way into being Bessel van der Kolk's client. You went right to the top. You're like, I'm not going to mess around. And I love the part in your book where you said, I can get a shortcut, a cheat sheet. Like, you just wanted to cut right through it. And so you thought, I'll get the grandfather of trauma and, yeah, and he'll make it all better. yeah. Also, what struck me is that each of these things that you did, aside from the tree frog poison, seemed to be a piece, right? It was a piece in your healing, but it didn't get to the core.
Yes, absolutely. And I think each thing that I did built on the next thing. It opened my lens a little more so I could see more clearly what had happened and slowly start to confront it, right? The system is only ready for what the system is ready for. So this doesn't happen in an instant. Right. But I would explore something, you know, I need to pause, and then I do the next, you know, modality, and I allow myself to kind of face more of the pain, and more and more of it started coming up as I've delved deeper. But it's funny because, as you're alluding to, I also had kind of had this mindset of like, oh my gosh, what if I just found the one silver bullet, like the one thing that's going to fix me? And I think a lot of people who delve into this work are hoping for that, you know, we're impatient. We want to see results. And so once I started working with Bessel, I remember asking him at the end of every session, I would say, so Bessel, am I going to heal? Like, what, how, when, you know, what's my quarterly healing report? And he'd say, yeah, you are. And he really believed, he gave me the confidence that I would, but
you wanted a date. You wanted to, on March 31st.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And what I came to understand, and I write about this in the book, is like, healing, first of all, is not linear. You don't go from point A to B to C, right? Sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back. And it takes time. It just takes time. And sometimes it's as subtle as just like a 2-degree shift in perception here or there. But as I wrote the book, you know, Bessel and I were doing our sessions over Zoom. And so I recorded all of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh. And so writing the book, I would go back and watch like a dozen of our sessions. And I would see what was happening, right? Because when you're in therapy, you can feel like, oh, this is slow. Am I making progress? Am I not? Who knows? But I would see what was happening. And oftentimes I'd like start rattling off something that happened, a painful experience from the past. And I just want to move through it and move on to the next thing. And Bessel would pause me. And now, you know, thinking back, I think every good therapist does this, but he would just pause. And as I finished a story, he would like exhale. He would just be like, or he would look so sad. And seeing that mirrored in him, seeing that empathetic resonance,
wow,
I would slow down and I would feel the fear and the heartbreak. And I would take a breath and then I would realize, okay, wow, that was really sad.
He allowed you to go into your body and feel it.
Yeah. And he would often ask like, well, how does that feel in your body? How does that feel in your body? And so it allowed me to like, A, get out of my head and into my body, which is really the key to healing. And it forced me to pause. Mm-hmm. It just forced me to pause and realize like, I need that moment to feel into this. And it gave me a safe environment to go back to these very scary, painful experiences.
Okay. We are past time for our first break. So if you are just tuning in late, my guest today is Jane Marie Chen, who is an accomplished author, inventor, and speaker. Today we are discussing her new book, Like a Wave We Break, a book about trauma, falling apart, resiliency, and the courage to heal. Today's program is pre-recorded, so we will not be able to accept phone calls or emails. After a short break, we'll continue with more of our conversation with Jane Marie Chen. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome.
I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in Unalaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who might be tuning in late today, I have the pleasure of interviewing author, speaker, inventor Jane Marie Chin. Today we are discussing her new book, Like a Wave We Break, which is a book about trauma, falling apart, resiliency, and the courage to heal. Quick reminder, if you're listening today, we are recorded. This is a pre-recorded program, so we will not be able to accept phone calls or emails. All right, Jane. One of the themes, like one of the things I mentioned at the start, is this book is just filled with love and hope. It's a story about trauma, but it's just steeped in affection, right? And like the relationship with your parents, and this stuff is all so complex. And, you know, I found myself, you know, really getting attached to the characters, you know, even your father and your mother and their plight, and their journey and their challenges and doing the best that they could with what they had, from their own upbringing. And we'll get into some of the historical trauma aspect, because this book has all these pieces. But I was just reflecting during the break that each of these things you did, I had this image of you building a structure, like little blocks. Everything you did was just another piece that you put in there. And I don't think you could have gone straight to Bessel and had the same reaction.
No.
So can you, talk a little bit more about that journey and the importance of people not getting too impatient or wanting that magic bullet?
Yeah, it's a slow process. You know, I what I realized was, like, in the beginning of my healing journey, it was all about doing. Like, I was kind of replicating what I had done in my work that led to burnout, but just putting the healing lens on it.
Yeah.
And at some point I was like, okay, I'm actually getting worse. And so this is like after my 10-day silent meditation, I think like my mental breakdown with it like intensified, you know? And so I finally, as a result of that, realized like I needed to slow down. I needed to pause. As I said, I needed to feel, you know, I needed to feel all those things that I'd pushed away for so long. And that's when I realized, like, you can't think your way out of trauma or work your way out of it. You have to feel your way through it, right? And you do that in community. That's what I learned, that community, my teachers, healers, friends, I'm so grateful for everyone who created that safe space for me to do that, right? But it's interesting, when I went to Bessel's retreat, the first time I met him in person, he did something called a psychodrama. Uh-huh. And so this is a therapeutic modality. It's a group therapy. And you pick people in the group to play the role of your parents.
I love this part of the book, by the way. It's so great.
Yeah, and you like reenact what happened. And then you pick other people to play the role of your ideal parents, and you play that out. And the whole idea is to give your body an imprint, feeling of what it could have been like to have a different experience, a more loving alternative to the things that happened. So I watched this at Bessel's retreat, and he did it with one of the participants, and it was like amazing. Like, she just had this huge breakthrough and catharsis, and I'm like in awe. And I thought, I need to do this, you know. And I really became convinced that if I just found the perfect ideal father, I would be fixed. If I found the ideal father who could say all the things that I wish I'd heard as a child, I would be whole and free, you know? And so at the retreat itself, I like chose a man who looked like Santa Claus to play the role of my ideal father. Turns out the big jolly white man was not my ideal father.
Not a good match, even though he was apparently a very sweet man, but not a good match.
No, not a good one. And so I tried this several more times. I didn't even write about all the times I tried it in the book, you know? And so I tried it several more times. And ultimately, I was like, you know what? I'm taking this into my own hands. I'm going to pick my perfect ideal father. I had a long list of people. I chose the person. And then I wrote down every sentence I wanted this person to say to me, right? I just like decided I was going to control the
Of
experience end
course you
to end.
did. You scripted it out, right?
Scripted it out, you know, picked the setting, the, you know, everything. And so the day came and this friend came over and we had it all set up perfectly. And he read the script to me, read all these sentences. And I felt nothing,
Nothing.
nothing, just I felt empty and I thought, oh my God, how could I was so frustrated. I was like, how could this not be working? This is supposed to be like the thing,
I've
you know,
accounted for
the
every conceivable thing, right? I've controlled
thing.
every part of this experiment. How is this not working? What's wrong with me?
So I'm like exasperated. And you know, there on my coffee table was a picture of 5-year-old me. And so I took that picture, I picked it up, I looked at that little girl, and I took the script that I had written for my ideal father. And I read every line of that script to that little girl. And I just said, I'm so sorry. You didn't deserve that. You are enough, and you are loved. And she finally believed me. I finally felt something, and I felt it throughout my whole body, just this warmth, you know, and this love emanating from my heart. And I finally realized all the things I was looking for out there, the ideal father, the perfect teacher, the perfect medicine, whatever it might be, all of that had to come from myself.
Yeah, it was in you.
And that's really kind of where the journey ends. And I think all of those things, to your point, were helpful. And I had to go through all of that to get to that point. But ultimately, we have to be able to give ourselves that love. And that's where the true healing is.
Yeah, that relationship that you developed and created with the little girl, with your younger self is really beautiful, and the imagery of you trying to find her and go to her, and her being huddled up in the corner and terrified. And, you know, I think it was Bessel who said, "We go at her pace."
And it took a while to develop that relationship, right? Because this part of ourselves carries, again, so much pain and we've neglected them for so long, right? So it took a long time to have enough trust with that part of myself that she could even receive that love from me.
Yeah, one of the things you wrote in the book was when you were talking about her is how you had gone out to save all the millions of babies and the little people who didn't have that, and you had left her behind and alone. It just is, it's heart-wrenching to think about that. And so many people do that with their little selves. They leave them in the dark and the cold and go about searching for things when it's really just turn around and look.
Absolutely. And we're often the meanest to ourselves.
Oh,
You know,
yes.
we're so critical to ourselves and that's the thing that's changed everything for me is having a relationship with that little girl and instead of like shaming her or making her feel bad if she makes a mistake or you know like she does something not perfectly like instead of doing that I've just learned to have compassion for that part of myself and to have more forgiveness, more capacity for that part. And you know, one way I'll just mention one way it's like really started to show up in my life. It shows up throughout my life, you know. And by the way, I think the more we have compassion for ourselves, the more we can extend that to others as well. And so that's allowed me to extend that to my family, and to my parents and to understand the way they grew up and how even the history of Taiwan, where we immigrated from, all how all of that plays into my story. Right. And so I really have a deep, deep sense of love and compassion for my parents, despite what happened. But, you know, recently I talked earlier about my public speaking fear, and I had this horrible fear after that incident of blacking out for 13 years. Yeah. I had to take beta blockers to give a public talk. You know, I was terrified of public speaking. I had beta blockers help, you know, with the physical symptoms of anxiety. And coming out the other side of this and really, you know, having a much stronger relationship with myself. A couple years ago, I was asked to do a big talk. It was like 500 people. Peyton Manning was the other headliner. I didn't even know who Peyton Manning was. Okay.
That's so funny.
And so they asked me to give this talk. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to take a beta blocker. I want to just show up as me, wow, regardless of what happens. And so the way I prepared for that talk was, instead of like, you know, visualizing success, like everyone tells you to do,
right,
you know, I did the opposite. I visualized like bombing that talk, blacking out, having to leave the room, all the worst things. And instead of shaming myself, I just had a conversation with like 5-year-old me. And I said, hey, it's okay. You're still loved. You're still enough. It doesn't matter. I got up on stage that day and I gave the best talk I'd ever given. The conference organizers told me it was the highest rated talk they had ever received, wow, in the history of the conference. And I've never had to take a beta blocker again. You know, and that didn't come from honing my public speaking skills. That came from just loving myself,
yeah,
enough to know that, hey, even if I make a mistake, so what? It's okay.
That the perfectionism you speak of, right? And the belief that a failure will define you somehow.
Yes.
Yeah, that's impressive. And just doing that, then it took away, because your speaking anxiety and the panic was really just about the panic. It was about that happening again. You know,
yes,
we become fearful of the fear.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But it's helped me think very differently, honestly, about what is resilience, right? Because I think the traditional notion of resilience and what I understood resilience to be was pushing harder, grit, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're struggling with something, we'll just put more energy toward it, endure, push through it, and still make it happen, right? And I did that and I broke. And so now my definition of resilience is very different. It's, how do we have self-compassion? Because when we have self-compassion, we can go out there and take risks and make mistakes and fail and brush ourselves off and know, hey, we're still okay. We're still worthy. We're still enough. And we'll go try again, right? That is true resilience to me.
The first time I ever did a radio show, I did it with Dr. Thad Woodard, who was sort of brought me in to do this show. And I had a friend on because I was so terrified, right? And, you know, afterwards I left the station and I went and cried because it was, oh, I was convinced that it was the worst hour of radio that ever happened. But I also didn't remember it. It was like this blur of an hour. And I listened to it later and it wasn't that bad. And, you know, I made a couple of mistakes and I still do. I've played my mistakes for my kids. You know, they were like, aww, "Oh my God, you said that on the radio, Dad." Or like, you know, or you—that's
really—that's
really bad. But yeah, that forgiveness of yourself to make mistakes and realize that it doesn't define you. And I guess that's the resiliency you're talking about, is to be able to come back from those times in your life when you didn't succeed.
Yes. And I love that you play that for your kids, because what a cool example. Like, okay, Dad made a mistake, so we can too, and it's no big deal.
Okay, we are getting up to our second break here. And I don't want to get into the story of, you know, talking about your parents before and then have to cut it off. So I think we'll go ahead and take our second break a little bit early. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Jane Marie Chin, who is an accomplished author, inventor, and speaker. Today, we are discussing her new book, Like a Wave We Break, a book about trauma, falling apart, resiliency, and the courage to heal. Quick reminder for folks, today's program is pre-recorded and we will not be able to accept your phone calls or emails. After this quick break, we'll continue with more of our conversation with author Jane Marie Chen. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us late, my guest today is Jane Marie Chen, who is an accomplished author, inventor, and speaker. Today, we are talking about her new book, Like a Wave We Break, a book about trauma, falling apart, resiliency, and the courage to heal. Quick reminder for folks, today's program is pre-recorded and we cannot accept phone calls or emails. All right, Jane, right before the break, I really want to get into, like, because it's not often that people write a memoir or a story like this so early in life. And you still have a close relationship with your parents and your sisters, and you know, you talk a lot about some of the challenges. And so I wonder, like, can you talk to us a little bit about that relationship with your parents growing up and your sisters, and how that sort of, I don't know, formed you?
Yeah. You know, I think, again, you know, it's just being as an immigrant family, we had each other. We didn't have a lot of other family that we could turn to. And so I was very, very close to both my sisters, but especially my younger sister. We kind of like did everything together, you know, and I had so much love for my parents. But again, you know, a lot of the pain I swept under the carpet. And so as I started to like face these things, I started having conversations about them with my family, with my parents. And I'll tell you why I felt compelled to write this book, and then we'll kind of dive into the family stuff. A couple of reasons. One, I was actually approached to write a business book years ago, and there'd been an article about my work in the New York Times. And so an agent approached me to write a business book, but it was interesting. It's the first time I ever thought about writing a book. But it just didn't feel right at the time. And then all these things happened with Embrace, the company shut down, all of that. I went on this healing journey. And when I came out on the other side of that, and healing, by the way, this is work I'll continue to do for the rest of my life.
Right.
But when
you're
I finally
not done
felt
yet.
Like Yeah. When I finally felt like I'd gotten to a better place, I thought, gosh, that's the story I want to tell. And that's the story I think will help the most people. And then what really kind of pushed me over the ledge, the scariest thing was, well, how is my family going to react to this? You know, and I was really anxious because I didn't want to portray my parents as villains or monsters. Like, I did not want that to be the case. And so I doubted myself. But then what happened was someone I grew up with, who was also a first generation Taiwanese American, he was maybe a year above me in high school. 5 or 6 years ago, this person killed himself. You know, he took his own life. And that really pushed me over the edge in terms of like wanting to tell my story publicly, because I realized that when we're silent, we're complicit. We're complicit. And then these cycles of abuse continue. And so I proceeded with writing the book. And I tried to bring my family along in the process. Like, I told them what I was doing. I was open about the nature of the book. And I also didn't go into specifics with them because I wanted to be able to tell my truth. Right. And so that was my goal. How do I tell my truth and talk about every character with love and compassion? How do I do those things simultaneously? which makes me so happy that you said you felt that love, even, you know, even as I was talking about difficult things, because that's exactly what my intention was. But to do that, what it meant was like, I needed to, again, have that compassion for my family. And so it was very important to me to understand, like, I didn't know a lot about my parents' history. They never talked about it. I didn't understand the history of Taiwan, where we immigrated from. Taiwan was under martial law for 38 years, one of the longest periods in history. In that time, hundreds of thousands of people were executed, imprisoned, including my grandfathers were both in prison, disappeared, raped, and there was so much violence and oppression. And so that's what my parents were leaving as they came to America. And I just really started to see like how they were brought up, what they were facing, the challenges they were facing. And I began to see how violence and oppression works its way into family systems.
Yes.
Into lineages. And so that's what gave me the compassion to understand my entire history, not just my parents, but even beyond that, and to see how did all these pieces fit together, right? What is my whole story? And I really have a different understanding of that today.
And I think that is what is most powerful about this book. One of the things that's most powerful is your ability to hold love and compassion and empathy for your parents who hurt you, right? And your mother who didn't protect you, but who also had her own ways. They each had their own ways of showing you love. And that's such a beautiful, you did such a beautiful job of still being able to love people who hurt you and see them as hurt people also, right? And even from the story of your grandmother walking down the street in pain because her feet had been bound her whole life, right? And you walking with her, you know, just a block was all she could manage, right? Mm-hmm. And so that piece filled you. So I do think it's so important to, for people who are going and doing this work to find that place of being able to say, yes, you hurt me, but I also love you, right? And that that forgiveness is such a big part of this healing, isn't it?
It is. It is. Because when we hold on to anger and resentment, I think we hurt ourselves the most. And this is not to say don't feel those things. I think it's so important to feel those things
absolutely
fully,
yeah,
so that you can move through them, right? So it's, and the only way to move through them is to feel them. And so I'm an advocate for feeling all of that so you can get to another place with it. The other thing I'll say here is, you know, it's interesting because I think this topic of estrangement has become very popular these days.
It has, yeah.
And I've been asked this question before of like, what if these, you know, these behaviors that are around me are just like not healthy for me? You know, how do I approach this? And the way I have, and I don't have a perfect answer to this, but the way I think about it is how do I both hold my own boundaries and keep an open heart? How do I do both of those things?
Right.
And sometimes that does require distance.
That's tricky.
It's tricky. And so when I was younger, I would be around certain behaviors that my father exhibited. And I didn't have bodily awareness. And so even in my 20s and my 30s, I would kind of just like be around that behavior. He can still like verbally lash out at my mother sometimes. And that was really, really hard for me. And so now that I do have, I'm more in tune with my body tells me, I start to like contract if I hear that kind of certain language.
Yeah.
And then I realize, okay, this is totally not healthy for me and I have to leave this situation. And so I've really learned to kind of draw those boundaries. And in doing that, I can actually have a healthier relationship with my parents, right? In drawing those boundaries, I can like love them and spend time with them. And sometimes that is at a distance, to be honest, but I maintain that open heart and I meditate every day. I try to send, you know, love and compassion to every member of my family. But I also know like I have to take care of myself and I now choose that over everything else. For so much of my life, it's like taking care of my company, taking care of other people. And now I realize like I have to take care of myself to be able to take care of other people and to make the impact that I want in the world.
Yeah, one part of your book that really illustrates that just beautifully is when you and your sister get up the courage to go and talk to your dad, right, about that. And he, you know, slowly or, I don't know, begrudgingly maybe says, I don't remember the exact words, but I could have done better, or I hope you can heal. And then you said, well, just be nicer to mom. And then 10 minutes later, he's upstairs telling her, you're so stupid, you should die.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of what I realized for this is like the exercise of talking to my dad, which was probably the scariest thing I've ever done.
I imagine. Yeah.
Scarier than write. I never even believed it was possible for so long. It was scarier than writing like the biggest wave I've ever ridden. But I knew it was important to do that. And one of my coaches like really, really encouraged me to do that. And the way I prepped for that conversation was to remind myself, this isn't about changing my parents, right? People are the way they are. Sometimes people shift and they change and that's great, but I don't think you should expect that to happen. So I really tempered my expectations there. But this teacher, her name's Diana Chapman, she's a leadership coach. She said to me, this isn't about changing your parents. This is about taking the hand of that little girl and standing up for her. Right. So this is about, again, strengthening this relationship with yourself. That's the most important part of this exercise. And that's what this served to do, you know? And so my dad, you know, doing that was just like another reminder that he's capable of what he's capable of.
Right.
And he may not change, but I'm still happy that I spoke my truth. And I think the more each of us stand in our truth, first, the more we're able to develop a stronger relationship with ourselves, and the more we create space for others to stand in their truth as well.
What about people? You talked a lot about the importance of talking to your parents and how powerful that was. What about people whose parents or the people who hurt them are dead or gone, or they can't talk to them? How do they get that piece in there?
Well, this kind of will go into kind of my spiritual beliefs, but I believe that we're more than just our bodies. And so I think that we're energy that continues to live. And so I think that you can still have those conversations with your parents.
Right.
And whether that be through writing a letter or through having a conversation with their spirit, I think that is still just such a profound exercise.
Okay, we're running out of time. We only got about 5 minutes left. I got a couple of questions for you. That one is, have your parents ever read the book?
So I did give my parents a copy of the book, and their English probably isn't great enough to like read it without a translation tool.
Right,
so.
Right.
Hoping it does get fully translated into Chinese. But my mother has read parts of the book, maybe not in its entirety. I'm not sure if my father has read it, but I will say I'm actually very proud of them and very grateful at how supportive they've been, because they know this is a hard story. They know like the content. I've been very open about that with them. Before the book was published, they were in Taiwan. I went back and I sat down with them and I really laid it out for them why I was doing this, why it was so important, what was in the book. And my mother, to her credit, said, you know, the most important thing to me is that this has helped in your healing process. And she said, if this has helped you, then it's worthwhile.
Yeah, I think it's really powerful that your parents gave you the space to do that, right? And that's to their credit, right? And part of why you were able to maintain that relationship, because they didn't cut you off. They didn't say, how dare you share our secrets, right? They gave you that space, even though they were sort of the source of that pain. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel really, really grateful to them, because these are hard topics to talk about, especially as you said, my parents are still alive. So these are very, very difficult topics. I feel immense gratitude You know, and it's scary for all of us, my sisters included, right? So the telling of the story and it being in the public has brought up different feelings for all of us. And so it's not, again, it's not a straightforward path. It's messy. And it's, you know, it's something we're all figuring out as each of us heals. Right. But I think, again, there's like, yeah, this great, great hope and the healing that it's bringing to others. That really has been the most rewarding part of this. When someone writes to me and they say, I feel less alone, I feel seen, I feel validated in my own experience, then I feel like, okay, this was really worthwhile.
All right. The other question I have is, you talk a lot about love in this book and your desire for love. And I wonder, did you find that?
Not that in the still form part of a romantic relationship. Okay. That's still ongoing. You know, I talk about two like very challenging relationships in the book and everything. And relationships are like your greatest teachers, right? Especially intimate relationships. And so they showed me like at one point, the second relationship I talk about, I've been through a lot of like healing modalities already. And I thought, oh, I'm healed. Like, you know, I can teach healing now. And then I got into that relationship and I was like, oh no, I'm in kindergarten. I don't know anything.
Yeah, the descriptions of your rage were amazing. Like,
oh my gosh. Yeah. I was like, oh gosh, so much anger came out of me. I'm so grateful again for those relationships as teachers because they gave me a window into something I could not see. And actually that's what led me to my work with Bessel. But it's funny as I started to write the book, I would like kind of imagine, cause I was writing it real time as I was living the experiences, right? This is not a memoir that you write like 20 years later and you're reflecting on what's happened. I was writing the stuff in real time.
It's fresh.
It's very fresh. And so I would kind of think, well, I wonder how this book is going to end and maybe I'm going to meet my perfect partner and get married and live happily ever after. You know, I kind of like had this fairy tale notion of what the ending was, and that's not what happened. And actually I'm so glad that's not what happened because the relationship that I ended up forming was with myself. And now I finally feel ready to find that love and find healthy love, right? And to be in a relationship where I can come to that as a whole person.
Okay, well, we are at the end of our conversation today. I only have about 30 seconds left, so I want to say thank you for joining me and for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
Okay, my thanks to Jane Marie Chen for taking the time to share her journey towards healing with us today. My thanks also to Line One producer Madeline Rose and today's audio engineer, Chris Hyde. For all of us at Line One, thanks to all of you for taking the time to be with us today. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.